talking about preparing and giving Bible teaching. Of course, when we actually give Bible teaching, we don't do it anything the way I'm doing it right now. I mean, this is just a couple of sessions where we're passing on a few practical tips, a few helps this way and that might be of use to somebody. But of course, when we're actually teaching the Word, most of it is just going through and expounding and commenting. And I was talking about applications. Just a couple of notes there. If we don't see an obvious application, I don't think we should force one in. Got to be very careful that we don't strain it too much. If it's fairly obvious, well, let's draw people's attention to it and make a suggestion as to how we might learn from this. But if it's not all that obvious, well, then just move on. We're not obliged to read four verses and make an application and read another three and make an application and a few more and make an application. It can, in fact, get a bit boring and predictable, which we don't want to happen. And it can get to the stage where we're rather straining things. The application should sit very comfortably with the basic meaning of the text. And then we've expounded a little section, and I can't think of anything in particular that is worth challenging the audience with, but we've explained a few verses. Let's leave it at that and just move on. Let's not feel that we've got to force the text to submit to what we want to do with it, but to open it up and then deal with it as naturally as we can in alerting people to how we might learn from it. Let's be very wary of our pet application. I guess we've all got them, and we tend to come back too readily sometimes to the obvious statement. It can be a bit bland, and it's not all that honest sometimes either. And also, people don't grab hold of it if it's just too broad. I pick people up in our local Bible study in our church sometimes where we'll be going through passages and people are checking out what they can learn from it and some of the lessons, etc. And I noticed that they were getting rather too glib at saying, oh, we've got to be obedient. So I just sharpened it up once or twice and said, you know, that sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, Christians, we should be obedient to the Word, obey God. We know what we mean by that, but let's be specific. So I just trotted out one or two verses that occurred to me as we were talking. Let's be specific about being obedient. What does it mean to be obedient? Well, the Bible says, for example, parents, bring your children up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. Well, there's an instruction. Are we bringing our kids up in the instruction and discipline of the Lord? It says, let no filthy communication or something come out of your mouth. That's a fairly straightforward instruction. Are we being obedient to that in the way we speak? And it doesn't take long just to settle on a few specifics, and the Bible's full of those sorts of instructions, especially when you get into the practical parts of some of the epistles, and of course the teaching of Jesus. Just trot out one or two of those things. And our problem is sometimes not with the understanding, it's with putting into practice what is a very simple, straightforward piece of instruction. Don't fight with one another, but be tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as Christ for God's sake forgave you. God for Christ's sake forgave you. Do we forgive each other? Very practical. So, you see what I mean? Sharpen them up rather than just have this vague, all-embracing comment that sometimes is so broad it doesn't actually hit anything. And then, of course, there's the one that talks about the glory. We're discussing a particular problem, an issue in society, and then nobody quite knows where to go, and then somebody says, oh, well, it'll all be right when we get to the glory, it'll all be fine then, it'll all be fixed up, and everybody nods approvingly, well, that got rid of that particular problem, and we move on to the next one. That's just a little bit of escapism there, isn't there? Just a little bit too glib, opting out of a difficult situation and sounding spiritual at the same time. Oh, some of the little wrinkles, some of the things to keep in mind as we are moving through. I've just got a note here about not talking down to the audience, treating people as intelligent human beings and not feeling that we've got to spell everything out. People are sharp enough as a rule to twig to what we're on about, and once we've said enough, well, that's enough, let them work the rest out themselves. And in the process, I hope, develop some of their own perceptions and do a bit of mental exercise. As I said before, we're not just trying to meet them where they are, but we're trying to lift them up at the same time. push a book through your mind. That's an expression somebody used once. In a sense, we're doing something like that, pushing something through the mind so that the mind is being expanded and more capable of grasping a bit more the next time we do another subject or book. Brings me to the topic of illustrations that we might use. I suppose they relieve mental pressure and they help to tie things in with the everyday. We've got to be careful that we don't overdo it, and normally an illustration should, in my view, just make one point. Don't try to get too much mileage out of the one story. And I think we must also be careful not to use them simply to entertain. If people remember the illustration, the story, but don't remember what it was supposed to illustrate, then we failed. And another thing, the more spectacular the story, the less, I think, it is going to be effective with people. Because it doesn't touch them. It is so spectacular that it's beyond their capacity ever to experience that sort of thing. I think the illustrations, if they're more mundane, down to earth, in fact, most of the illustrations in the Bible, you get a few stories here and there, but most of the illustrations are by way of analogy, where one thing is likened to another. Jesus is likened to a vine. I am the vine and you are the branches. And so you've got this analogy that just as the branches are part of the vine and partake of its life and produce fruit, so we are part of Christ, partake of his life and produce fruit, and so you can develop the analogy. We had this morning in Isaiah the analogy of this big wall and people sheltering under this wall. And so just as people are sheltering under this wall, but it falls on top of them, so they're trusting in this alliance with Egypt. But it's going to fall on top of them. It's going to bring them undone well and truly. Just a very simple analogy. It doesn't take long to say that. Probably 10 or 15 seconds is all it needs to get that analogy out, and people will normally see it. Now, what I'm saying is this, that if we deal with the Bible the way it's given to us, we will never be short of illustrations or pictorial data, because the Bible is written in pictorial language. It's very down to earth. Even the doctrines of the Bible, most of them again are taught in very concrete terms. Now the problem with us is that we've been brought up on a sort of Greco-Roman heritage where we think conceptually and we've got abstract ways of thinking, which is not all that common in the world of the Bible and the Bible era and the Bible time. Particularly the Old Testament is very concrete rather than abstract. And most of the teaching was got across in saying, look at that, and drawing an analogy from that and dealing with the people accordingly. Even the doctrines of the New Testament, almost all of them will come out of everyday settings, justification by faith. Now we deal with that in a very cerebral way, a very theoretical or abstract way at times, but it comes straight out of the courtroom scene where you've got a judge and you've got a person standing before him, and the guilty are condemned and the righteous are acquitted. And that is developed with theological definitions and developments from that courtroom scene of people standing before and one way or the other. Redemption, it comes out of the slave market where people are in bondage and somebody goes along and pays the price and they're bought out of it. Very concrete. Adoption. Got pictures in the Bible of ancient Roman life and of people adopting somebody into their family to get the family in name and inheritance and pass it on. The law was a schoolmaster or a custodian or somebody under whose control we happen to be to lead us to Christ, but he said now it's all gone. Again, it's presented in this picture form. The fatherhood of God is a father. And you can just go on right through the Bible. It is very down to earth and very pictorial. And what we've got to do is somehow loosen ourselves out of this very abstract sort of Greco-Roman way of thinking that we've inherited and come to terms with the Bible and realize that this is where ordinary people are. And they're not thinking in abstract terms. They're thinking in very concrete terms about how I can fix the kids or how we can deal with this problem at school. And that's the sort of book the Bible is. And that's why I think it's so good the way it is, because it just comes out of all different sorts of circumstances. 66 books. The background to these books varies enormously, but that's what life's like. No two of us are the same. The backgrounds we come from are not the same. And so the Bible has this tremendous variety that's just dealing with people where they are, and we learn different things from different books. What we've got to do when we read the Bible, I think, is loosen up. We're too pietistic at times for our own good. We sort of feel very spiritual and we've got to become rather artificial when we read the Bible, and it builds up a sort of mystique around it which is rather artificial. We've got to loosen up a little bit and try and slot ourselves into the time of Isaiah or whoever the person was. And picture what they're talking about. I can see Isaiah stand. I don't know whether he had pink satin pants and purple gaiters or, you know, what sort of a hairdo he had. But I can picture him there rubbing elbows with these toffs and top johnnies in the local public service. And he's in and out of the government offices and he's bumping into ministers of state. And they're running to hide, actually, when they see Isaiah coming, because he's got a message the politicians didn't like. And so you're playing a bit of ducks and drakes with Isaiah. But he's getting his message, and you can picture him. You can see Amos coming in from the bush. He's smelling of sheep dip, and he's got cow dung between his toes, and he walks in there and he stands up in the market and he starts to let these people know what he thinks about them. And so it goes on, book after book, the narratives. Moses and these people going through, and they're all whinging about this, that, and the other thing. Well, Moses tears his hair out and says, goodness me, whatever you do with a bunch of characters like this. And you can see the hassles the man's going through. You get to the doctrinal parts, you get to the Psalms, which again is all, we take it heavenly. But if you look at Psalm after Psalm after Psalm, the imagery is very concrete. All the imagery comes out of everyday life. I was going to look at, you've got to be careful doing this. I did this once and I said, well, you can turn open any place in the Bible. And I turned open and fell open the Song of Songs. And the first verse my eyes lighted upon, I thought, better not read that one. Anyway, I've gone back a book or two to Psalms. You rule the ragings of the sea. Its waves rise, etc. There it is. You crushed Rahab. That was a genuine fluke. Honestly, I didn't rig that. Here it is again. You crushed Rahab, the great sea monster, like a carcass in the seas. You scatter the enemies with a mighty arm. Every sentence, every verse. The heavens are yours. The earth is yours. The world you made it. The north and the south. You've got a mighty arm, strong as your hand. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. There is a throne, you see, and righteousness and justice the foundation. All very concrete. And you can go through the letters of Paul, you can go through Ephesians, any book of the Bible virtually. Go through the Pentateuch, full of laws. And we say, oh, strike, it's boring. It's not boring at all. All these people with ox, some ox bites somebody else's ox, or it gores it, or a fella falls down a hole, or somebody burns off his field and it catches onto somebody else's house and it gets burnt down, and what do you do with this sort of thing? And it goes on and on and on. It's fascinating stuff. It's interesting. And what we've got to do is get away from this very pious way of reading it and understanding it and feeling that you've got to feel in the heavenlies when you read it. There's nothing terribly heavenly about the way some of these chaps had to hassle with the problems that Moses had to deal with in sorting out. And we just got to see how is the life of the people of God affected by a relationship with God in the ordinary, everyday, nitty-gritty of life. And so somebody does this to somebody else, what are you going to do? And Moses said, well, this is what you do. And we just come to see it. It's a very down-to-earth book. And if we can't picture these things ourselves, we've got Buckley's chance of helping the audience to picture them. What we've got to do is work a lot more on developing our imagination. Unfortunately, it's going backwards in the West because of TV and all these other audio visuals that tend to fossilise the mind to some degree. Watch advertisements and just sit and watch. And we've forgotten how to think and how to imagine. And you get the people who are in societies that don't have all the gadgetry and telecommunications and audio visuals that we're accustomed to here. Often they have better developed imaginations than we have. And I think probably they're closer to understanding the Bible for that reason. Well, one could go on about this, but we've somehow got to picture it. We don't need a whole lot of material. We don't need to set up a drama thingo and all sorts of props. We can just imagine it, and by using our hands and expressions, we can somehow get the idea across. We've got a pulpit here. Moses brings along, or somebody brings along an offering of an animal. So here it is, this is the altar, let's say. The character stands there, the priest, he cuts the animal's throat, stick it up here, put it, there's all bits of wood and fire and stuff, and put the... You can just, by using your hands and a few rectangle mannerisms, it's amazing how people can lock into it. I can see these fellows bringing their animals there in the book of Malachi. They're dragging along this sheep that's got half its ear missing and tail's broken off and one leg's dragging behind, and they're going to offer this as a sacrifice to God. Old Malachi, he says to them, hey, what's going on here? He said, you wouldn't offer that to the local governor, would you? I said, oh, well, it's going to die anyway. I mean, we may as well give it a decent burial. Bring it along here, offer it as a sacrifice. And Malachi says, what's going on here? But can't you see those people? I mean, we do exactly the same sort of thing. Not exactly the same, but the same sort of thing in principle. Give God what we don't want ourselves and think he ought to be very grateful. And so God gets the rough end of the deal so often. In our time, in our money, in our... Well, you can go on and on, can't you? That's the sort of thing I'm saying. If we can just picture, just loosen up a little bit and enter into the spirit of what these people are saying and help the audience to see it so that they can respond and get enthused about the word. And the best thing is when they do get enthused about the word. The greatest thing is when you finish doing a series on something and then somebody comes to you and says, why? I'm really switched on. I'm going to go home and start reading that book for myself. And I think to myself, that's what I want. I'm not worried if he forgets my sermon. But if you've enthused him about reading this particular book and he goes home and starts to read it for himself, I think we've really achieved something. And that's what we should be doing in our churches. I'm not really worried if people don't remember what I said. And my sermon outlines are not normally of the sort that you're going to memorise anyway. Now, if you're the sort of person that likes to put things in little packages and people can memorise it, well, fair enough. But I'm not really worried whether they memorise it or not. I'm not worried if I remember what I've said, but I am interested that they've understood the Bible. Because they're not going to go back and listen to me, but they are going to go back and read the Bible. So when they go back and read the Bible, I hope that some of the things I've said have been so locked into the text that they read once before in church that now it will start to ring a few bells here and there. It's the word that's the message. We introduce them to the word. We lead them into the word. Everything is devoted to helping them understand the word, because that is the one thing that they're never going to get rid of. Or we hope anyway. We assume you're always going to have the Bible. But they're not always going to have my voice or my sermon notes or my alliterated outline or anything else. Concerning notes, one man's meat is another man's poison, the old saying goes, and you just work out how you do it yourself. Some people like a lot of notes and some people don't like too many. I like them to be nice and brief. I've got a system where all my notes fit on one page of a piece of paper that size, and I can fit into a small folder and go with me. Concerning biblical exposition, most of my notes are just a few little jottings made around the margins of the Bible. I'll come to this a little later on, I hope. Because most of it's in here, and I treat notes as memory joggers. Now, all that writing out business I talked about before, I think is necessary to clarify our thoughts and get our material sorted out. Once I've got all that, these are just memory joggers that I take into the pulpit with me, and I set them out in a certain style. You underline some things, you can use colours if you like, a bit of white paper, indent, leave a space, so that your eye can pick up just the odd word here and there. I've given a little bit of a tip in the book in one of the working examples as to how we might use notes. But other people prefer them to be extensive. Probably the person in the world that I've got most in common with in the matters I'm talking about today is a man in England called Alan Newt. Whenever I get to Alan, we get together, whether it's over there or over here. We are so much on the same wavelength that it's great. It's great when you get a person that is just right on the same wavelength in almost everything you're saying. His ministry is totally different from mine. Our style, our personalities, our language, our expressions, they are different, but fundamentally we're doing the same thing. So that's what I'm saying. You can do in principle the sorts of things I'm talking about and yet have an entirely different way of doing it. I'm a bit rough and ready and I have these outline notes. Alan is precise. Every sentence is in place. And he has notes and notes and notes. A few years ago, 15 years ago it must have been, in Melbourne when he was in Australia and we were sharing a few conferences together and I was sitting in the front seat. And I started to panic. He's just flipping over his notes, page 7, page 8, page 9. And here's me with my business. And you start to panic. Oh, my God, grief. I said, how do you get through that? And he said, I couldn't survive on the sort of notes that you have. And I said, I couldn't survive on that. I said, that would kill me. He said, well, this to you would be Saul's armour. Will it? It would be. So I just give that little illustration again. I don't want to tell anybody they've got to ape the sort of thing that I'm doing or copy all these things I'm suggesting. Just get the ideas and sort it out ourselves. We're all different. We'll develop our own style. But you pick up a few little tips along the way, it may help. Sometimes I write out the opening sentence, especially if it's a dicey subject. You've got to be careful you don't get up there and hum and ha and if and um and ah, and you're never quite sure how you're going to start, and even worse, how you're going to stop. So sometimes I will get the first sentence straight and the last sentence straight so that I get a clean start and a clean finish and no problem. I haven't done that today, as you probably will have gathered by now. And if there's something in the body of the talk that is one of these issues that's rather difficult and you want to say it precisely, again, it's worth writing out. You can memorise it, or else just cast your eye down and make sure you're picking up the key words. I think you'll also find you can devise a way of writing out a statement in abbreviated form so that you don't have to read every single word. But it's wise at times to make sure you say exactly what you want to say, no more and no less. You know some of the dicey subjects you've got to speak on at times. But you just work those into the sermon. Nobody knows that you've worked it out. It just happens to be there in the way you've planned it. And when the time comes, you say exactly what you want and keep moving on. Just a few little wrinkles like that. Yes, I will write key sentences out now and again just to help me through, but by and large I tend to take it as it comes because I've saturated myself before I start and I feel at ease with what I'm talking about, and I've got my notes there to jog me concerning the things I want to say. Again, if the headings are worth remembering, well, I gave you a few before. If you want to remember those, well, fair enough. That's the sort of talk, I suppose, where you could have headings. But the sort of talk that I gave on Isaiah this morning, there was no point in giving any headings there. It was just breezing through a few verses and seeing what the book was saying. Again, I try to use concrete rather than abstract terminology and try to keep it non-intellectual. I try to avoid all those academic-sounding words. I've used one or two today, I know. But then I'm not expounding the Bible today. We're speaking in a different context here. But I try to avoid all those words that tend to turn people off or that tend to isolate the speaker from the audience. They think he's a bit academic or intellectual or something like that because he's used words like conceptual, which I used a few moments ago. I've never used a word like that when I was preaching normally. It's also advisable, I think, to keep a list of where we preach. I've been doing this ever since I started. I can tell you everything I've ever spoken on, time, date and place. Well, not time, but date and place anyway. Nothing worse than going back to a place and doing what you've done before and then somebody reminding you of it later. I think we've got to be organised in these things. I file notes away. These sorts of notes, I don't necessarily keep these indefinitely. The research material, I do file that away, but these I often work up just for the occasion. That's why it's nice and fresh. And your applications vary from time to time. So your base material can be reused, but the way you adapt that material in different sermons is going to vary from time to time. As you come back to a thing 3 years later, you can find it can take quite a different flavour, have a different thrust and emphasis. Okay, let's move on. I've got a number of things to say about prayer, trusting in God, allowing Him to work and so on. I've discussed those in the book, and because of time I'll have to shortcut that, not because it's unimportant, so don't get me wrong. But perhaps I just could remind ourselves anyway that sometimes when we think we've gone well, there hasn't been a lot of spiritual fruit anyway. I think most of us have had this experience. Sometimes you've gone terribly. You think, oh boy, that was. You want to go and hide afterwards in case people come up and talk to you. You just feel you fouled the whole thing up. And it's amazing how often it comes back. The 3 weeks later, you're talking to somebody who was challenged or helped by that particular talk. It's just a reminder to us that although we ought to strive for excellence, we ought not to think that the spiritual fruit is going to depend upon our particular ability. We've got enough verses in the Bible to tell us that the work is of God. And Paul, of course, reminds us of that when he was in Corinth. He says in in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, around about verses 4 and 5, he says, "When I was among you, I wasn't all that clever. My speech was this and that." And he said, "I didn't have my usual oomph and fluency." But never mind, he said, "at least your faith is going to rest in God and not in the personality or style of the speaker," or words to that effect. You know the sort of reference I'm making there. Always remind ourselves of that. That's no excuse for sloppiness, but it is a reminder that without prayer and dependence upon God, we may be simply striving for a quality of performance and not really interested in the spiritual fruit that is God's main concern. I mentioned this morning about winning people's favour and being a bit slippery and buttering up the audience and whatever other illustration you can think of. I don't think we need to say too much more about that. We're not to be insensitive, but neither are we to be running with the hares and then hunting with the hounds and changing our stance depending on how we judge the audience to be. Just looking for approval and congratulation and perhaps even a financial reward. I think we've got to be very careful of that type of thing. Okay, I won't develop that anymore either. Taking notice of the composition of the audience is worthwhile. One might say things here that perhaps I wouldn't say if I was in a certain type of a church on Sunday. That's not because you're shifting your stance, but because you're there for a certain purpose and you know that the audience is geared to a certain type of study and you're geared up to half a dozen lectures a day and you've come here for a certain purpose and so you can deal with the subject in a certain way. But on a Sunday morning, that'd come in a different atmosphere, it's a different sort of meeting, so obviously the way you'd handle a subject has to be adjusted accordingly. The more we can find out about the audience and who's going to be there, well, the better, I guess. But by and large, if we just take the Bible and the way I've been using it, I think we'll find that everybody's going to get something from it. And they're not necessarily all going to get the same thing. But the Word of God has this remarkable capacity to penetrate the lives of different people. Got to be very careful also of singling out certain groups. This annoys me sometimes. Oh, we've got a few young people here tonight. Let me say something to the young people. All the oldies sit back. Sock it to them, mate, the young people. They don't cut their hair. They wear the wrong sorts of shoes. And I don't think we should be sorting out old people, young people, middle people, fat ones, skinny ones, tall ones, short ones, lady ones, man ones, or anything else. We should just be dealing with the Bible in this straight up and down fashion, and people will get the relevance. I was in a place not long ago where somebody introduced me, and he wanted to interview me. I shouldn't have got onto this story. Terrible when people want to interview you. Asked all the wrong questions, takes an awful long time to do it, and really then you've said nothing. If he had given me 2 minutes, I could have said succinctly all the things that he was wanting me to say. But then he said, "Now, Don, you know quite a bit about talking to young people, don't you?" I said, "Oh, no, not particularly." Well, I said, I said, "I had a few of them myself at home, and they all seemed to survive, but..." No, I said, he made some other comment. I said, "No," I said, "I've got no special lingo for young people or old people or fat people or anything else. We just talk in ordinary English that anybody can understand." And this very patronising talking to young people or talking to old people, the teary-deary language I call it. "Is that all right, dear?" You know, become very patronising to this old people and all the itsy-bitsy language we've got for little kids. It's teensy weensy and the GG does this. I'm like, "Well, that jolly GG. It's a horse. Just kids call it a horse." And teach them some ordinary English. And children can understand. I don't speak to my grandchildren all that much differently from who I speak to anybody else. I don't have a special language for those under the age of 6. And then another language for those something else. A bit of thought and treating everybody as ordinary human beings with a brain to think with, and not drawing attention to their age, not drawing attention to the fact that they're young people or old people or little kids or something else. That's right off the track. Anyway, I've said it, haven't I? So I hope it's of some use. But communications is at the heart of our problem, you know. This whole communications thing is one reason why we're not evangelizing, because the average Christian's got no idea how to talk with the non-Christian person. The only way they seem to be able to talk or to evangelize is to bring them into our context. And we get them into our church where we feel safe and secure from all alarm, but they are most uncomfortable. But this is our subculture, and we're safe in our subculture. And then we can dish up the spiel and hope that they understand it. But to get out there onto their patch and to meet them where they are and just to talk in ordinary language, and all of a sudden we find that so much of this doctrine or whatever it is we've got in our heads, we don't know how to communicate in ordinary language to people out there. So this whole communications thing will be the subject of the next conference. No, not really. But I think it's something really has to be looked at, this whole communications area. All right, coming to back to the Bible, where we were supposed to be talking about expanding the Bible. As I said this morning, when people come together, it's all right for me, I'm hot, but everybody else is cold, so we've got to take that little time to settle them down and to introduce the subject and paint a little bit of a picture, just give a bit of background without telling them its background, so that they can see who Isaiah is and where he is and what he's doing and why he's talking about these things, and as soon as possible get into the text. Now tomorrow, when we deal with how to teach the Bible to non-Christians, I'm very strong on this idea, teaching to Christians or non-Christians. In the first talk, let's get as far into the text as we possibly can. I think it kills a study when you've got the first of five studies, and after the end of study number one, you have finished verse two. And you know there are six more chapters to do. And then you start to think, goodness me, what's going to happen here? That very first talk, if we're doing a series, I think we've got to get as far into the book as we can so that people have got a taste of the book and are enthused to come along to the other talks and to join in with us. So, a number of considerations there. I've dealt with some of those in the book, so I don't think I'll go on any further there. I've got a note here about beware of sweeping statements, and especially where there may be an exception. This comes in relation to issues such as prosperity or suffering, and we know that those are areas where there are lots of unanswered questions, and people make these broad statements which simply won't stand up. Prayer, you get people making the most outrageous claims about what you can and can't do with prayer. And I don't know of any subject in the Bible that has got more loose ends than prayer. If you've got anybody who's nailed it down completely, then I say don't believe them. There are so many facets that you just can't lock it in to a simple formula that you can throw around with reckless abandon. So we've got to be so careful that we don't make sweeping judgments which someone in the audience is going to find out, or is going to realise, is simply not true. And our credibility has gone out the window, and most likely they'll take no notice of anything more we say. The same with our illustrations. I'm very careful. If I give an illustration, it's about something that I know about. Now, you probably have gathered from now, I don't give a lot of little stories. I have lots of quips and side comments and a lot of analogies, and I tend to picture things and see things, but I don't build up a lot of story-style illustrations. I'd be particularly wary of doing so in an area of life or community that I wasn't familiar with. For example, if I was out in the country areas talking to a church that was largely farmers, I'd never give an illustration that had anything to do with farming, because you've only got to be a little bit out. And they're all sitting there, and they say, this fellow from the city, I mean, what would he know about it? They're justified, I suppose, in taking that attitude. I was in a study once where there weren't very many people there, and we were kindred spirits, so there was no harm done. But one chap gave an illustration of something that happened. He made a comment about coagulation of blood and some miraculous answer to prayer. What he didn't realise was that there was a pathologist in the group. And when the discussion, and this fellow had shared his nice story, the pathologist said to him, Well, Bill, I appreciate that it may have been an answer to prayer, but all that you said about blood is just a load of hogwash. He said, it's simply not true. And, you don't give those sorts of illustrations when the pathologist in the audience. Just be very careful that our credibility doesn't go out the window for a very minor blunder, like some sort of illustration. Um, Yeah, there's quite a bit in the book about using some of the illustrations from the Bible, seeing some of the humour in the Bible. I've also got a note here about giving an up-to-date modern equivalent sometimes. Just to, like I mentioned this morning about Rahab, who sits still, I said, like a paper tiger. And then the wall fell down and crushed the thing like a potter's vessel. And I mentioned a bulldozer runs over a bit of crockery or something and smashes it to bits. You can easily just update a thing in one sentence. It only takes 5 or 10 seconds. It's not going to take much of your sermon time. But immediately, it anchors the thing in the present day, and people can see the life and relevance of some ancient document. We don't want to leave them with the impression of something dry and dusty and old-fashioned and out of date. We can take it in its original context and just in one line give some sort of up-to-date equivalent that might help people see things. Another thing is to concentrate on telling them the facts rather than telling them how they ought to respond to the facts. I think this is very important. I've got a friend in Brisbane. He's a very good friend, a dear brother who's been a loyal prayer supporter and other supporter for a long, long time. He's no slouch when it comes to understanding and teaching the scriptures either. But he has this great problem of feeling that he's got to tell everybody how great this truth is that he's just discovered. And if only he could get us to see how the glories of the Lord here, if only he could help us to see how marvellous this is. And he's trying to find all the adjectives that he can find to build us all up, and people are simply not getting enthused. What we should do is just calm down a little bit and paint the picture in such a way that they will automatically respond. We tend to dig our heels in when people tell us how we've got to respond. The worst offender is Bill Collins, you know, the movie guy with the red coat that does some of the movies. Oh, you must know Bill. Yeah, now don't you? Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes. I know you're going to be moved when you see this. And if you listen, and I'm sitting there thinking, I bet I'm not. Bill doesn't have to tell us how we're going to be moved. You go in a video shop and read the blurb. If it's from Bill Collins, it's always dead hopeless. It will always tell you how you're going to respond. You're going to be moved to tears, or you're going to kill yourself laughing, or you're going to be shaken as you've never before. You think, well, I didn't need Bill to tell me that. We ought not to tell people how they're going to respond, because they almost always won't respond like that. We simply present the material in such a way that they can see something of the contrast here between the Lord exalted and these people in captivity in Ezekiel running around doing things. Present it in such a way that they will make the response. We ought not to tell them how they should respond. The other thing here is about going through a section or any part of the Bible. I've got a little, it's a small, I suppose, rule of thumb, you might say. It didn't start off with making up this rule and then conforming to it. It was just one of the things that occurred to me as I've been doing this for quite a number of years, that I can roughly cover an amount of material where the number of verses we read, meaning the person who's speaking and the audience, we read together, the number of verses we read is roughly the same number of minutes as I have to speak. So if I've got a 30-minute talk, I'm pretty sure that I can get through the exposition, and the number of verses we read together is going to be 30. And I could do that quite comfortably. Now, we might take those 30 verses out of a whole chapter of 45, so I've got to select the verses that are going to make the most impact, and then I can ad lib between, because I don't believe our job is to give a verse-by-verse exposition of every verse in the Bible. I might take 3 or 4 chapters of a narrative, and there might be 3 or 4 chapters, and there might be 120 verses. Again, I can choose the clumps of verses here, and then I can tell them what happened, and then David did this, and after that, and then we read the next 6 or 7 verses. Well, after that, they went around here and something else happened. If you go to chapter 3, verse 1, we'll pick up the story there, and then you'd read the next 3 or 4 verses, because the verses you've chosen are the ones that are going to make the impact. They're the ones we want them to see, and out of which our applications are going to arise, I hope. You can probably cover 3 or 4 chapters comfortably in half an hour, but again, the number of verses we read are going to be about 30. And we know we can do it comfortably. Now, this morning I spoke for 13 minutes, and I just checked out. I think we read, you and I together read 15 verses. I also gave background and introduction to the book, and we managed to make a few applications and comments on the way through. So we did that comfortably at that same rate. I've got four chapters in that book that deal with how to deal with various parts of the Bible, an Old Testament historical book, or a prophetical book, or a gospel, or one of the other New Testament writings, and we'll deal with them in different ways. And some places you can skip over material more readily than you can in others. Obviously, with most of the New Testament letters, you would probably go through the whole letter and deal with all the verses. But we don't necessarily have to do that in, let us say, the book of Samuel. Well, as I say, there are working examples if you want to follow it through. What I often do with my own Bible is mark the down the column just with a ruler and put a line down the number of verses. They're the verses I'm going to read. And then at the end I'll say go to verse 16, which is over here. I've got a line down there and I'm going to read these verses. And then skip over three or four and read these. And when we read them, people will read them with us. I want people to read them off the page. So that I will say, now if you look at verse 16, most people will look at verse 16. And because we're doing this all the time through, they don't get a chance to go to sleep or even to tune out, because every couple of minutes you're saying, now if you look down at verse 21, you'll find that Isaiah there says, and they'll look to 21. Unconsciously they will do it. In most places you will occasionally get the audience in certain denominational circles that aren't used to looking at their Bibles, and no matter how many tricks you try to try to get them to look at their Bibles, they'll just sit there looking at the preacher. I'm wanting them to look at their Bibles. I'm wanting people to see that what I'm talking about is actually there in the Bible. And when you explain it, you can almost see people saying, oh goodness me, it is there. Why didn't I see it before? And then we move on and talk a little bit more. And if you go down to verse 10, they're all very, all the eyes go down like that. And you read the next few. It's the Word speaking. Let the Bible speak. Let the Bible do its stuff. And so the Bible becomes the sermon. And three quarters of the sermon is simply explaining the text and letting people see what it means, and then we make a few suggestions as to how it can apply. And people don't tune out as a rule. I find that they'll hang on in. People say, people can't concentrate these days. Can't concentrate for 40 minutes. Well, I'm not sure if that's true, but unfortunately people tend to believe what the motivational research people tell them. They say, oh, the segments on TV are only 6 minutes and people tune out. Well, look, even if they do tune out, I'm not worried if somebody tunes out for a minute or two and goes shopping while I'm talking. As soon as you say, look back at verse 11, they'll wake up and they'll come back to where you were. So it's got its advantages in keeping people tuned in and moving through with you. And if they don't hear everything I say and they do tune out for a few minutes, I'm not terribly worried over that. Doesn't matter, they probably haven't missed all that much. But if they've got the content of the Bible, I'm happy, because that's what I'm trying to do, get them reading the scriptures. Well, I've run out of time, and you'll have to take it from there, I suppose. Whatever you can pick up extra out of the books, now you'll find those working examples develop a lot of the things that I've given. Now, if we had another four or five sessions, we could now go through in detail and look at different parts of the Bible. We don't have that luxury, but there's a chapter apiece on those four areas of the Bible that I've chosen, and each time I've dealt with it in a slightly different way, just to give us some idea of how we can go about doing it. I don't expect any person in this auditorium will do it exactly the same as I had done it. I'm not expecting you to agree with everything that I've said, but I hope there are some tips that we've opened a few windows here and there, and then you can take some of those suggestions, hopefully, and then develop them according to your own style and ministry and gift. And may the Lord bless all of us in the ministry of making known the Word.